This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 62 for Monday, May 11th, 2009, website scalability. This week we talk with Mike Tai and Matt Stratton from Apartments.com. Mike and Matt share with us some of the techniques that they've used to scale out their website to millions of users per month. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm recording a podcast in downtown Chicago. I'm here at the offices of Apartments.com, and I'm talking to a couple of their guys. Mike, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Mike Tai. I'm the Director of Development at Apartments.com.
And Matt?
I'm Matt Stratton. I'm the Manager of Technical Operations for Apartments.com.
And I'm also joined by a special co-host, and we've mentioned him a couple times on the show. It's Dave and I's colleague, Wade Wigner. Wade?
Hi, Wade Wigner. I'm an architect evangelist here in the Midwest. Work with Larry and Dave quite often.
You also work a lot with Mike and Matt from Apartments.com, right?
I do. They're some of my favorite customers to work with.
Yeah, these are great guys. And we're here because you guys are going to talk to us a little bit about, you know, scaling web applications. And we've talked about this a couple of times on the show, but this is kind of an in-depth, you know, what do you guys do in the trenches in the real world? You know, we do have a worldwide audience, and I know you guys do business primarily in the United States. You might have some people that are looking for, you know, your properties, you know, outside the United States. You might get some traffic there, but most people may not know what you do. So could you give everybody a thumbnail sketch?
Sure. We provide apartments listings across the United States, and we have many different types of listings, from premium properties from the big management companies to the private party customers, and then also with our affiliate newspapers, we have classified listings.
So you help people find apartments, which is something that they do quite often. You guys get a lot of visitors. Matt, you want to share some of the facts that we were talking about earlier?
Right. Yeah. We average between 4 and 4.5 million visitors a month to our site.
That's unique visitors,
unique,
right?
Unique visitors, yeah. So there's a fair amount of traffic. Again, it's in this kind of industry, you're not seeing a lot of super sticky, because the same people aren't looking for apartments month over month over month, or at least you hope that they're not, you know.
Right.
you hope that you find your apartment and then you like it, and then
you're there for a couple of years.
Right.
Probably.
You come back, see us in a couple of years. So there's a fair amount of traffic. And the other thing is, our traffic is cyclical throughout the year too, because different times of the year, there's more interest in looking for apartments. People are looking to move, obviously tied in with the school year. Not so many people maybe are necessarily looking to move in the middle of January. So when we talk about scale, we have to be able to survive our busy time and not become overloaded when we get to those types of scenarios.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, there's definitely seasonality. I remember when I was an apartment dweller, that I would look, you know, at the end of the school year, or every 6 months, I'd probably do, you know, a 1 year lease in a lot of cases. But is there also, you know, peaks within a month? As you come closer to the end of the month, or is that not really?
It tends to be kind of static. I mean, we actually have busy times throughout the week, and even throughout the day. You know, we don't get as much traffic on a weekend, for example, and not as much, you know, overnight. So, which I guess is telling us that when people are looking for apartments, they're probably doing it at work. Lunchtime is actually very – lunchtime, you know, across the time zones in the United States, around the lunchtime and the early afternoon is some of our busiest time. So
you guys are in the central time zone. So probably about 10, 10:30 your time, you start seeing, you know, a little bit of uptick because of the people on the East Coast, and it – probably carries through to, you know, 3:30 in the afternoon when the people of the West Coast are wrapping up their lunch.
Exactly. So that middle part of the day is when we see our highest load. And again, mostly Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, not so much on Monday, not so much on Friday. Chances are on Friday people are not wanting to think about finding an apartment or something of that nature. We still do get traffic.
Oh, absolutely.
The middle of the week and the middle of the day seem to be the times. And again, so like I said, we have to build for to support that, not just the low times. So.
And with 4.5 million unique visitors, that's a lot. I mean, that's an appreciable number if you're looking at the total population of the United States being 300 million. I mean, that's a good percentage of the traffic. I mean, you guys aren't Facebook, but then again, you're not the small website. So you guys are definitely have dealt with some scale concerns. Tell me about your growth. I mean, have you been at this, you know, rate for a couple of years? You know, have you seen an uptick?
It's always growing.
Okay.
Year over year, the number of visitors, I mean, even month over month. And again, as the economy changes too, you know, rental, the rental industry is going to change year over year depending on what's going on in the economy. So we will see changes with that, but we do see a steady growth. So we continue our capacity planning and look towards that and have to be able to scale out as we continue to grow. You know, the same way that you designed something 5 years ago when you had 50% of the traffic, which is a made up number. I don't know that that was, I'm not saying that was the case, but
right.
When you go back to that, you can't always look at when you're looking at how you're going to scale, you always have to look at the next generation of where you're going to be. You can't just say, I'm just going to throw some more hardware at it. We're just going to throw some more servers at it and just keep doing business as usual.
Yeah, you can get some boost in scalability just because the hardware platform is increasing, but it tends to, you know, scale does funny things, you know, to traffic patterns, things that worked at half your volume. It's not like you got to double everything and it's going to automatically work. Some things you can't double and have them work, and some things doubling it's more than efficient. Or what are some of the techniques that you guys have used to help you guys scale over time? Because I think that's what people are most interested in. Now they got a good background about what you guys do.
From talking about the pure infrastructure, there's a couple things that we do. One is we definitely look towards the attitude of scaling out. Which goes back to what we were just saying, rather than just saying, hey, we're just going to throw more hardware at this stack, we're going to distribute outward as much as we can. And one of the places that we do that as well is by offloading to a content delivery network for things that, again, it's much easier to leverage something like Akamai, who are in the business of speedy last mile acceleration, get this bit to the customer no matter where they are in the country or in the world as quickly as they can, rather than us having to say, I'm going to build out all of this giant delivery network and be able to be as close as I can to the customer.
Right. So what you've done is you've offloaded a portion of your workload to a third party vendor. You know, in this case, Akamai, there are a couple other, you know, CDNs that the pattern is still the same, that I'm going to have somebody else do a portion of the work. What are the kind of things that you offload? Is it the typical images? Is it a lot of people will offload large PDFs, a lot of different things, but what are the kind of things that you offload?
We definitely offload things that would be considered static. So any parts of our site that are dynamic, that are computational, that's all handled within our servers. But we offload images. Obviously, given our business, one of the most important things when you're looking at an ad for an apartment, well, they're going to be pictures. You want to see what it looks like. So we have a lot of images, a lot of high-resolution images, which we offload to the CDN. And what that allows us to do is not have to spend all that bandwidth on our side to continually push them. But also, those big files get delivered to the customer a lot more quickly. We also offload JavaScripts, CSS, files of that nature that are small, that aren't changing constantly, and video as well. We have a video product, so the videos and the player for our video is also distributed through our CDN.
So I was going to ask specifically about the quasi-programming assets, like CSS, because a lot of people think, you know, obviously the images, you know, video files, you know, audio files, if you guys had them, you know, would be an obvious, you know, workload. But the CDN actually, and we didn't cover this a minute ago, and we probably should have, the CDN makes multiple copies of it. It's close to you from a network perspective, so that if you're in Los Angeles, California, you're getting from a point on the internet that's close to you. A different one than the guy in Des Moines, Iowa. Different one than the guy in North Carolina. Fast response. But it does mean that there's some distributed caching going on.
Absolutely. And actually, the thing about when you talk about the distributed caching, given our business model, when it comes to things like the images, it really works to our advantage. Because chances are, so if there's a property in Los Angeles, California, most of the people that are looking at that property are probably geolocated similarly. Granted, you know, like you said, maybe someone's moving there from New York or something.
Right.
But most of the hits that are coming to the properties in a certain area are all going to be in the same area. So it's one time that image gets loaded into that local geocache server, and then boom, for our network or piece, and from that point on, it's being delivered from cache. So it's very efficient for us because they don't have to go back to the origin constantly, because there's people from all over the place. Again, with things like our JavaScripts and our CSS, it's a little bit different, but those are files that don't change and that are very common across the whole site. So all it takes is the one guy in Des Moines, he calls it, he gets the style sheet. Now everybody in Des Moines is going to get it from cache, and it's going to be super speedy.
Right. I was just wondering that from a latency standpoint, let's say, and I know this never happens at apartments.com, but you discover an error in your JavaScript that it's not working on some, you know, version of a browser, and you want to make a fix to it. It's adding one line with a semicolon at the end, you know, to do a check or something like that. You say, great, I got the fixed. I push it out. I guess that there's the when is it going to be fixed question. It's going to be, well, when is it going to get pushed out into the cache, right? So it could be minutes. What do you guys see?
Well, what we do in a case like that, if there's a file that has to be fixed, is we purge that file from the cache, and we can do that through Akamai in several different ways. One is a manual way where you, through the web interface to Akamai, we can go in there, we can purge a specific URL. So same thing, make a change to a CSS, want to make sure that that's changed. We go in, tell Akamai basically, hey, on all your servers, purge this. So the next time, it'll come in and get the new one. And that usually takes about 5 to 10 minutes to replicate through the environment.
Okay.
And the other thing that's kind of cool is that Akamai has an API that through a web service. So when we upload new property images where we know, hey, it's not necessarily a fix, but we know that that's changed through our process that does all this, it makes a call out to that web service and will purge it.
Oh, so
it's done programmatically when we know what's happening. Now, again, if it's a break fix situation or a, hey, we know we just have this one file that's got to get that, that can be done manually. But our batched up new images and things like that are programmatically purged from the cache.
Oh, so your process is it's a kind of a wrap transaction that actually copies the file out there, invalidates the cache, you know, does a multi-step process. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and it was very important to be able to do that because it's the longer that we can set the cache to live, the more efficient it is.
Absolutely.
So what we had seen in the past was concern about stale images or stale files, so we were very, very conservative with our cache, and we would set it very short, which meant that, okay, that's true. If there was something new, it got replicated pretty quickly, but it also meant that most of the time we weren't using the cache. We weren't optimizing that content delivery network, and so you really want to – they usually say that you want to be hitting origin. When origin is talking about coming back to your server, that the cache doesn't have it, either on your side or Akamai side or whatnot, usually the ratio should be about 80% from cache, 20% back to origin.
Okay.
That's kind of the sweet spot to be at because that's where you're really going to be leveraging the speed and the optimizations of the CDN. So as we got smarter about being able to manage these cache purges, we were able to push the cache TTL out a lot further and use it a lot more. And we've seen some great performance improvements from doing that, and also just general reliability on our side. It's things we don't have to worry about. I can offload that CDN, let Akamai worry about building the super robust way to do everything.
Mike?
Yeah, one thing I want to add, you were mentioning before, Larry, about you can only throw so many servers to solve the performance issue. A lot of things that we do are actually for performance between the client browser and the server.
Okay.
As far as, page size and things like that. So, you know, we do some of the standard things on the server side for server performance, like ASP.NET caching, page level caching. A lot of our pages are dynamic for those cases where, you know, we might have a property listing. We obviously want it to reflect the changes if a property manager makes a change. But if we set the duration to something like 5 minutes or something, the delay there is acceptable, and the performance for that caching works really well for us. But what I was mentioning before about the from the client side down to the server, a lot of the issues we run into are around that. And we've done certain things like we use our big IP for page compression, so try to minimize the download size of the page.
And you mentioned Big IP, which is a hardware appliance. Kind of, you know, for people who may not be familiar with it, you know, kind of say what a hardware appliance does for you.
Okay, I'll defer this one to Matt.
Okay, yeah. So what we do is our server farm sits behind a hardware load balancer. In this case, it's provided, you know, it's a F5 Big IP. And what that hardware load balancer is going to do is it's going to take in all the incoming requests, and we have configured inside the load balancer pools of servers that say, hey, okay, you're coming in for www.apartments.com. Here's the 8 servers that are capable of fulfilling that request. And so it is set up depending upon certain rules, and for certain services we have it configured differently. Say, okay, here's my eligible servers. I'm going to fire that request off to him. So it's a load balancer, but it also, as Mike alluded to it gives us other benefits as well, one of which is, You can offload SSL to it, for example, which is great. So then you're not running the SSL on your servers. You're letting the hardware handle that. But in our case, we use it for the compression. So it runs a gzip compression on everything that all the HTML type files that come down, which what that's doing is any modern browser can interpret that.
I was going to say the great majority of browsers now support gzip.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, perfectly.
You know. Yeah. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone that had a problem with it at this point. And I'm pretty sure that it actually is going to only send it to browsers that will support it. I'm trying to remember how we have that configured, but I'm pretty sure we've got our
That's actually
covered.
An HTTP header that the browser will serve. As I understand it, that when you see a browser that doesn't support gzip, it may be a browser that supports gzip, but it's not requesting gzip. It's generally due to a proxy server sitting in the middle, and oftentimes is what I heard, a misconfigured proxy server. That's one of the things that as they're troubleshooting something, they'll turn it off and just forget to turn it back on. But gzip is phenomenal because, you know, as we know, text data generally compresses very well, you know, when you run it through an algorithm like a gzip.
Yeah, and like Mike said, it gives us two great things. One is just in terms of performance. Obviously, the smaller amount of data that you're pushing through the wire, the faster it's going to get to the client. But also, the smaller amount of data we're pushing through the wire, the less our bandwidth bill is.
Right.
You know, so, and there's some real improvements in terms of that particular piece of the bottom line that you can get by doing that kind of compression. You're using your pipe as efficiently as you can, both for performance and cost reasons.
And are you guys, you mentioned that it's possible, are you guys offloading SSL onto the device?
We do. We have certain pieces, certain sites and services that we have that go through SSL. So that is offloaded through the big IP, which is one less thing that we have to configure back on our IIS servers and have to manage there. Plus, it's so much more efficient on a hardware device that can do that. It takes resource requirements away from the web servers, who can then be spending their time and their energy doing more interesting things than just encoding SSL.
For people that aren't familiar with this, it's actually a card that you slide into the device that is optimized for doing the public key doing the asymmetric and the symmetric encryption. The SSL endpoint is no longer on the server. So if you actually were to sniff the wire traffic on both sides of the device, everything coming in from the internet would be SSL encrypted. Everything between your device and your servers are not encrypted. But at that point, that's inside your data center. You've got, you know, control, and the security is in place there. It's not like it's ever, you know, I didn't want to freak anybody out when I was explaining this, right?
Yeah, that's the great thing about that, because your big IP is sitting at the edge. It's outside of the DMZ. And so, but your server, so when that unencrypted traffic is happening, it's happening within a protected network. It is sniffable, but not sniffable to the outside world.
Absolutely.
You're talking edge to edge your SSL once you get inside the protected network. Then that also lets things move a lot faster, too. Inside.
And this takes, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it takes a lot of load off of your web server. And what you want to do is you always want to optimize the web server for doing the business logic, not for serving the images, not for doing SSL encryption and decryption. Because remember, it's not only decrypting it from the browser, it's encrypting it, sending it out to the browser.
Yeah, I just want to add another thing. In the past, we've looked at non-hardware devices for compression, like IIS6 could do compression, and you can buy add-on utilities that'll do compression. And I think, like Matt said, the nice thing about Big IP doing it is now you don't have to configure every server and, you know, forget that, oh, one of the many front-end servers we have doesn't have it set correctly. It's nice just to have that device in the front end from a development perspective.
And that's important to note. There's the implementation, which is, in your case, with multiple servers, is probably best done on the device. But if you're looking at how do I scale, you know, my small website to get more out of my server, one of the things you could do is enable gzip,
right,
you know, on the server. The other thing is there are SSL cards available for the actual web server themselves. So you could even offload it, you know, if you were a single, you know, in a web server type of an organization. So you could take advantage of these same patterns you're talking about. You don't need eight servers and the big IP to do this.
Right.
So you can adapt some of these features.
Right.
That's good to note.
Yeah, the other content distribution network we use is for our ad serving. That's one of the things that we have to make sure that the request from the client side performs well for our users. We do a lot of monitoring to make sure that because of the ad serving, the source of the data coming in isn't controlled by us. And we put in techniques in place to make sure that, you know, if an ad is having problems serving, from one of the networks that they have that the page still renders and it doesn't hold up the page for the user perspective. And so we've worked with the ad serving company to, you know, use things like iframes, more things that can run in parallel so that, again, so that if an ad is having trouble, the rest of the page loads. Our tech ops team does a good job of monitoring to make sure, you know, on a regular basis that there is no ad out there that's performing poorly that impact the users.
Or worst case, 404, some type of timeout error, right?
Right.
Because when they're looking at your web page, you know, they're not going to give you any forgiveness that the ad,
right.
It just looks, the page looks broken. They're not going to say, oh, that's an ad served from some, you know, ad vendor, right?
Exactly.
So next technique that you guys are using for scale?
We also do things with our database as far as pushing data out to multiple database servers. From a database perspective, our database performs really well. We do things for database optimization one of two ways. If we're having issues, we do tracing to see where the offending calls are. This is both for our front-end database and for our back-end operational database.
Okay.
And then we also periodically do tracing and look for patterns of how our users are searching our site. So if we find out that more people are doing free-form city-state searches versus a directed search where we have everything optimized, we might change how we index our data.
So you might add indexes based on how the traffic pattern or the search pattern of the user changes.
Right.
How often do you guys update your stats on your database, or do you know?
I feel like that's a daily job. We'd have to get that confirmed from our DBA team. There, we have some pretty elaborate maintenance plans in place, and not elaborate in terms of very complex, but elaborate in terms of very thorough. So it's all very scheduled, and again, it's all based upon the best practices that have been determined from years of understanding how this data is consumed from our websites. Kind of standard database maintenance.
I'm curious, over the years, what sort of changes have you made to your databases as there's been more traffic and you've discovered things and learned things about your databases? Do you know the types of changes you've had to make in order to support more users or to scale them out?
Probably more with changes in functionality of how we want to design our database. For example, how we display our images. When you search for properties and we show the results set back and we show a preview of the image, the images are stored in a separate table and we want to minimize the number of joins we have when we display the results page. So we make decisions that say, okay, you know, maybe the first image we store differently than the rest of the images because we know that the results page is going to need that data. And we've also have cases where in our data set we have the apartment properties and each property can have multiple listings. And again, that's something that if you're doing a search and you say, I want to find an apartment with the two bedrooms and other features that we have to go down to the model level, we have jobs that aggregate that data up to the property level so that when you do a search, we're not joining against the model data. So I think it's more when we come across functionality that requires more data that we're currently retrieving, how do we design the data and make sure that the data is optimized.
So you're specifically denormalizing the data to improve that query, but you still got the data stored separately. You know, it's almost like you're creating a view that doesn't require the join, right?
Right, right. So our back-end data is our denormalized database, and then we have jobs that we call our aggregator jobs that pull the information from the model up to the property level.
Okay, so I'm sure there's a couple of hundred developers out there listening that have this burning question that they want to know. Stored procs or inline SQL or both?
Pretty much stored procs. I mean, we have a lot of code that both from our front-end application and from our back-end. You know, we try to do everything through stored procs. We probably have some cases where there's inline, but the general policy right now is to do stored procs.
I've been answering that question for like 10 years, what should we be doing? And it seems to be the never-ending debate. And I think that it's as the technology has changed, the performance benefits of stored procedures, you know, the optimizations that every database vendor, but especially Microsoft SQL Server, have done have brought them close together from the performance standpoint. But architecturally, from a security standpoint, I still tell everybody, use stored procedures. It's much cleaner. It gives you that extra little bit of layer of abstraction that can sometimes really save you.
Right. And right now we're taking a look at the entity framework and kind of bridges between the inline and stored procedures and kind of like you said, Larry, taking a look at the pros and cons of security as far as, you know, what store proxies to give us and the processes that we have in place today to ensure that things are pushed correctly and the boundary between what development can do versus our database administrator can do.
Right.
Kind of gets lost when you start looking at entity framework and just trying to find out what's the best approach for that.
Related to that is, and this is another question that I answer like all the time, you know, what's your opinion on, you know, session state? And because we haven't yet talked about how you distribute load in the big IP, and it's kind of irrelevant, right? The fact that you've got the devices, the, you know, the nice architectural, you know, piece of it, sticky sessions or not, because if you use sticky sessions, then you have more choices for session state. So
yeah, I could start and then, so our front end website is sessionless. And
cool. That's the best, most killer answer you can do.
Yeah, I mean, it does present some problems as far as, you know, trying to keep a mini session either in the cookie, passing it in HTTP context or something like that. But our front-end web server, you know, it's pretty much read-only until the point where you want to actually contact the property. So there's not that much data that we have to save on the user. Some of the things we do for performance, for tracking, again, we send some of the data off through a third-party site to do some of our activity tracking. So again, we don't have to, for that, keep track of the user session as they go through. We use a third-party site. We can report what kind of traffic patterns users are using. But as far as like the session list, you know, for the most part, it hasn't been a hindrance for us for the front-end website. We do have, you know, other applications for capturing more forms-based data and some of our back-end applications that we do use session where it's more data-heavy and passing data from page to page and keeping context of a user, where performance isn't as much of an issue of saving that session into a database versus the front-end website.
So do you guys use SQL Server Session for those? Or?
Yes, we do.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's generally that's where people, you know, wind up, you know, SQL Server Session. But absolutely, I fundamentally believe it's a real challenge, but having a stateless web server in the front end is from a performance standpoint, you can't beat it, because at that point, there's nothing that you have to do, you know, to retie you back to server affinity or offloading it to a separate one. It's fantastic, guys.
Yeah, and we do things as far as you know, we talk about future things that we want to do that will store more context for the user, and how do we do that? And even for those things, we can optimize when we actually save something to the database versus, you know, saving something temporarily to a cookie. Until the point where they commit an action, like, you know, saving favorites might be an example of, you know, here's my favorite properties that I've viewed on the site. And for us, we can save that in a cookie as far as which properties they viewed. But if they want to do something more advanced in the future as far as saving notes and other things like that, that those things maybe only occur when you actually – the user takes an action and the slow performance is acceptable because they've just, you know, saved something to the database.
So it sounds like you guys, you know, have got features, you know, beyond just like the catalog view, you know, of the apartment. If you're talking about like somebody saving notes and favorites, and it seems like you guys are thinking about the entire process that somebody goes through.
Like I mentioned before, right now when you browse the site, you know, our primary goal is providing you the listing and providing you all the contextual information around the listing to help you make a decision on whether you want to rent the property and then let you communicate with the properties them directly. And as we're growing the site more and more, you know, we add more and more of those features. And one of the things is, you know, to allow you to, you know, customize your experience a little bit more. And those would be the things that would require us to do a little bit more saving of data. Again, with our sessionless application, you know, we probably would still keep it sessionless. But like I mentioned before, have specific users' actions that would save things to the database.
Cool. You guys haven't mentioned web services once. And I know that, you know, from talking to you guys before we started recording, that you guys do some things with web services. Do you want to talk about those, Matt?
I can talk a little bit from the infrastructure behind them, because there's actually quite a bit of what allows us to scale in how we've implemented that. And then, you know, Mike can probably talk a little bit more about what those services do and from an app perspective what we've done. One of the big things that we have done, though, when we approach our services in the interest of scale is a lot of times we don't really know how much this service is going to be consumed. It comes out there and we say, okay, well, we know that it's going to be deployed to be used in this way, but we want to make sure that we don't, you know, kind of paint ourselves in the corner and build it out in such a way that, hey, if a developer comes up with a whole other way to use this web service, whereas before we thought maybe it was going to be 10 users a day and now all of a sudden it's, you know, 50,000, I want to be able to very easily scale to that. And one of the ways that we do that is that we build, again, when we talk about by being behind the load balancer, is our services are generally set up as separate pools. And pool, again, is a collection of servers that can serve that request. So rather than saying we have just like one big, this is all of our services and they're all underneath that, in which case I would have to do that, I would have to sit, if I had one pool of servers that served all web services, I have to scale them all together. What we do is we have individual pools for each service. So, hey, if service A all of a sudden is off like hotcakes and I really, really need resources, I can just bring more servers into that pool. We don't have to reconfigure anything. I just throw more servers at it, be they physical or virtual, and nobody's the wiser except that it's supported better. But I don't have to bring, I don't have to throw that scale at service B that still has 10 consumers.
And do you use the URL to distinguish, you know, what service pool to go to?
Right, and it can, and that can be done in a couple different ways. You can do it on the FQDN, or you
fully
can
qualified
fully
domain
qualified
name.
Domain name
for the acronym impaired.
You can also do it based just upon the path. So, for example, if we had, you know, webservices.apartments.com/service A, and you could also have webservices.apartments.com/service B, and they look like they're the same server, but they're completely different servers behind the load balancer.
Those could go to two different pools.
Two different pools.
One could have, you know, two servers in there, and the other one could have 20.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool.
Exactly. And that's how we differentiate that way. And there's a couple different reasons we went back. And one of the advantages of doing it based upon the virtual directory concept as opposed to the domain name concept runs into a couple places. One, not the least of it being, if this is a web service that needs to be presented securely, if you used a different FQDN for every one of them, that's a whole other certificate you have to buy.
Right, unless you do a wildcard certificate, which doesn't always work.
Those aren't too happy. And right. The other is, there's also just to get sort of some standards around it, too, is to say, hey, we don't want to have to know that there's the, you know, all these different names, and there's certain emerging standards for how you name web services, especially if there are services that are going to be consumed by an outside party, not necessarily just internally. And it just helps sort of masquerade that a little bit. It makes it look like we have a consistent, you know, edge to that, but we can move it around inside as much as we want.
So, for instance, if your fully qualified domain name says, you know, apartments.com/service A, you can remap that to serviceA.asmx, and in the future, if you need to change that to, instead of .asmx, to .svc, literally the client doesn't have to change its reference as long as it's spitting back the same result, right?
Exactly. It's basically, it's giving us the ability to have a friendly URL when it comes to that.
That's hot. So what are the hot things do you guys do?
When it comes to the services, too, like we said, I know we're also leveraging WCF, and this is something I'm going to let Mike talk a lot more about because, again, I'm the infrastructure guy, so I know what the servers do that run it, but what the application's doing on top of it, I could try to speak to it, but it would probably all be wrong.
I love the infrastructure guy, you know, who knows a lot about app dev, but then always pulls the card that says, you know, I'm just the infrastructure guy. You know?
Well, I mean, we kind of take advantage of that on the development side because, I mean, in some ways, we have an easy job. We make sure our services are stateless, and we know our scale-out technology, and we know that tech ops can do things with the domain names. And so we work closely with them on a project and say, hey, we're building the service, and we might not know exactly how many users or applications are going to hit this service, but we know our general pattern of scaling out, and we work with tech ops and come up with what the domain name is. And like you mentioned, Larry, if that's something that has to change later, the calling application doesn't have to change, and our back-end application, you know, we'll make whatever changes we need.
Yeah, you've got that instant layer abstraction, which is always good.
Right.
And I'm sure that you guys would never go to them, but, you know, you got to take a hard stance that says, you know, nobody's ever going to convince me to not map that, you know, service independent of all the other ones. It's
right.
Like, no, this is just like the other one. Why don't you just group them together?
That, right.
That can't happen or the whole thing falls apart.
I think one of the keys to success for our development environment is that we work very closely with the tech ops. And even though we joke about, like, you know, Matt says he doesn't know what's going on with development, and we say we don't know what's going on with tech ops, we both kind of understand a little bit on the other side. And both of our groups have the common objective of making things scale and perform. And because we work closely together, we come up with a good solution ahead of time versus, you know, when it's time to deploy and say, well, okay, Matt, you know, put it out there. Matt's like, I don't know what this is. I don't know how to design the proper infrastructure for it.
So you mentioned you're using WCF. I'm just curious, in what ways are you using WCF? And how, you know, when it comes to scalability, how have you defined your services? How do you use them?
So one example is for our image processing system that we use internally. We process a lot of image property changes every day, probably something in the order of 6,000 images that we have to process every day. And so a lot of things that we do requires queuing. And so for one of our image processing servers, we use MSMQ tied to WCF. And so it's really nice for us as far as, you know, not having to build our own queuing technology and just being able to queue up the image request to the WCF service and then have the WCF service do the image processing and then, as we mentioned before, send those images out to Akamai to be hosted.
So when you say image processing, what kind of things are you actually doing with the image processing?
So we get a lot of feeds from our partners and from our property management companies. They'll send over their properties and say, you know, I want you to refresh all my images with this set of images. And as you can imagine, with a lot of our larger management companies, there's a lot of images that we have to process. And we do things for performance to make sure that, you know, we detect if an image has changed or not, to try to minimize the impact as far as replacing every single image that we get. We also get a lot of images from our customers who send from our other line of business, our Rent Homes Plus site. We have a lot of partners that also send us ad listings that they capture that they feed over to us, which have images, and we do the same things for those feeds. We process them every day, and again, there's thousands of images in there that we have to process.
And I got to think that you want to optimize, you know, the images, especially with so many people running around with 10 and 12 megapixel cameras right now, that you get images that probably are too big. So you wouldn't want to start caching those and pay for the bandwidth to serve those up only to have the browser resize them to,
right,
you know, to be small. So optimizing for your standard image size is probably something you do. Do you do anything like watermarking or anything like that?
We don't do any automatic watermarking. What we do is we have multiple standard image sizes on our website.
Okay.
So again, you know, certain things like thumbnail for the search results, and we have a couple of different image sizes. So in the end, we want to make sure that the user browsing the site, as you mentioned, Larry, isn't downloading a, you know, 4 megabyte file, that they're getting the size optimized by us. And so that's part of the image processing that we do, is we standardize and all the images that we get into the different sizes that we know we serve up on our front end.
So another question, I know some of the more recent services you guys have been building out have consumers that need to be cognizant of the size of the message sent back to them, and you guys have put a lot of thought into that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So one of the things we're working on is, as Wade mentioned, is, you know, a service that we can use internally and, you know, maybe someday externally for applications to retrieve apartments data outside of our core website. If you're talking about an application that's primarily a client application that uses Ajax and other things like that, we want to make sure that the data size coming from the application, from the server to the application, is the smallest size and the best format. So a particular API that we're working on, you took advantage of WCF to be able to return data in multiple formats such as XML and JSON. And that's worked out really well for us because, you know, certain applications which are client-based may consume JSON better. And, you know, once they get the data in JSON, they can optimize how they develop their application versus other applications may either a server application or a client application that deals with XML better may be able to use something like, you know, link to XML to consume the service. And for us, using WCF was a good option there because there was very little work we had to do to say, you know, okay, WCF serve up, you know, XML versus serve up JSON.
Yeah, and the more open you can be to your client developers, the more interest that they'll have in it.
Right.
A lot of people talk about the payload size between XML and JSON, and I've done a lot of tests on this, and JSON is about 20 to 40% smaller. The real advantages to a web developer is there's no parsing of JSON.
Right.
And you literally, you get the results back and it's live data, you know, whereas, you know, if you got that back in Atom or RSS or just POX, you know, you'd have to do some manipulation on the client side.
Parse it first and then manipulate it.
And you know what? I gotta say it this way, man. Parsing in JavaScript just stinks. Man, that's a lot of code that you don't want to write. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think from the WCF perspective for that, we weren't so much concerned about the size of the data, but more, like you were saying, Larry, as far as the consumer of the data and
making it friendly. Yeah.
Right.
There's some new features in the there's a REST toolkit for WCF services, and one of the things that'll let you do is actually meter the number of requests from a client. Because what you don't want is that if you do open your API to client developers, you don't want some guy, you know, going nuts with a script, you
right.
know, that's banging on you, you know, every 30, 40 milliseconds. And most public APIs, you know, the Flickers, the Twitters, you know, the Facebooks, all have the concept of an app key and then a meter. Well, that's actually built into WCF. It's really cool. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to write any of the code to say, how many times have I seen this app key? It literally doesn't hit your service, you know, if they've exceeded some threshold.
Yeah, those are the types of things that we look for in WCF versus just a standard SOAP-based service. And, you know, a lot of things that we do when we're building out new applications, the complexity isn't so much in the actual business logic that we have to do, but things that we want to support operationally, such as logging, monitoring, and things like that that are consistent across all of our services. And, you know, we look for WCF as a good starting point for that and going forward with that, taking advantage of new features.
Well, cool. I want to thank you guys, Matt, Mike, and Wade as a special co-host. Thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. Or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd. Mean to crack everybody up.
That's exactly why we did it, Larry.
Because it's hot.
Because it's hot. You know, that's a driving pattern for us here.